Welcome to the Shambhala Sunday Gatherings podcast. Each week, we invite a guest presenter from the Shambhala community to talk about what is meaningful to them or to share a brief Dharma talk. These explorations range from the reality of impermanence, death, and the unknown, to how we express and work with joy, contentment, and fearlessness in our daily lives. Presenters offer a guided meditation or contemplation practice and invite reflections, comments, and questions from participants about the poignancy and complexity of our shared journey on planet Earth. Thank you for joining us for this week's Shambhala Sunday Gathering podcast.
And good morning again.
Good afternoon. And
it's always morning in Shambhala. I heard that somewhere. Welcome to this Earth Day celebration with Shambhala's Touching the Earth Collective. And I think, are we all here? We're all here, right? The steering committee. And in case you haven't heard this before, the mission of Touching the Earth Collective is to inspire and engage the warriors of the Touching the Earth Collective to uphold the healthy sustainability of the sacred living environment for all beings. Clearly seeing the need for an urgent response to human-caused environmental degradation, Touching the Earth warriors invite individual and collective action for the rebalancing, protection, and celebration of a healthy living world. The collective acknowledges that many of its members live and work on the homelands of indigenous peoples across the world that were unceded and subject to colonization. We honor these original peoples who have long stewarded these lands, and we celebrate their resilience, the richness of their languages, traditions, and cultures. We recognize their enduring and continuing relationships to the land, past, present, and future. We appreciate that the origins of our own Buddhist and Shambhala traditions arose from indigenous Tibetan culture, and we are grateful that these traditions have been able to grow and be nurtured on so many continents. We seek to respect and support Indigenous people's sovereignty. I'm Deborah Luscombe, your host, and I'm coming to you from the unceded lands of the Mi'kma'ki on the eastern seaboard of Turtle Island. And now I'm going to turn the baton over to one of the steering committee. We are all five here. My dear friend, Irene Woodard.
Thank you, Deborah. We'll begin with a bow. Thank you all for being here. This is terrific to be sharing this Earth Day with you all. Well, the day before Earth Day. We're going to begin today with a lasung, and I'm going to go outside on my deck here. I'm at Sky Lake, which is in New York, and I'll do a short lasung, and please, you may share this with you. Here we go. Re, the virtuous mark, the great banner of inspiring wind horse, and these clouds of offerings of all desirable things. We offer to you, great being Gesar, with your retinue. Fulfill all our wishes, be victorious in all directions. Re, the virtuous mark, the great banner of inspiring wind horse, and these clouds of offerings of all desirable things. We offer to you, great being Gesar, with your retinue. Fulfill all our wishes, be victorious in all directions. Free the virtuous Mark, the great banner of inspiring Windhorse, and these clouds of offerings of all desirable things. We offer to you, great being Gaysar, with your retinue. Fulfill wishes, be victorious in all directions.
Thank you.
So, welcome to our celebration of Earth Day. This is a first for, in a way, we're touching the Earth Collective. Due to the good diligence of Deborah Luscombe, this will be a historic calendar, everyone. Save these calendars. It's the first time that Earth Day is actually listed in the Shambhala calendar. So thank you so much, Deborah, for your work with Mr. Mermelstein in Halifax to have that happen. Another first today is it's the first time I believe that the whole steering committee is here for one of our Nita Day, well, Nita Days or Sunday gatherings. So this is great because part of what the collective is a collective of leadership. And since its inception in 2018, the Touching the Earth Collective has been collectively led by different people, but a steering committee. And currently, the steering committee is made up of Deborah Luscombe, Gregory Webster, Sarah Demetri, and newest member, Dickie Swaback, and myself. So there'll be an opportunity to meet and hear from each of these people today. One of the programs I've listened to this week, I was on a webinar, and there was a quote from Rachel Carson. The more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and realities of the universe about us, the less taste we shall have for destruction. I just wanted to read that quote out loud. The way we've advertised this day, this Sunday gathering, was that we felt that we could each celebrate in our own way and express in our own way how we were feeling and about protection of the earth or any aspect that we're excited about or sad about or have really any feelings about where we are on this Earth Day. So I'd like to invite another member of the steering committee to begin and present whatever you have planned. We have not discussed amongst us. We are going to surprise each other about what we're going to be presenting. So if one of you would like to take it away, that would be great. Karen.
I'm very unoptimistic. These are terrible times. Just terrible, terrible times. Politically, economically, for the earth, I feel like that old song, we're on the eve of destruction. That's all.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I'll jump in. And there's David. Hello, David. He's muted. Anyway, I've just joined the Touching the Earth Collective Steering Committee.
Hello, Dickie. It's so wonderful to see your face.
Yes, likewise.
It's been a long time.
It has been. Anyway, for the people that don't know me, I've just joined the steering committee. Seems like maybe a month or two ago. And I will just give a little background just to introduce myself. I've been living at Shamala or Drala Mountain Center for more than 23 years, and I'm still living here. I've retired, but I'm providing a lot of institutional knowledge. So I volunteer almost every day. There's always questions that come up that I have to answer. My major interest in the last couple of years has been birding. And I've also been involved in presenting some programs here. We're calling them Mindful Birding. We just started this year. And we've had two classes already. We have another one scheduled, I think, for in June. And over the years, I've been photographing birds here. I've documented about 65 or plus birds that either live here year round or migrate here for breeding purposes or just pass through. My early interest in birding or birds, when I was a teenager, I raised pigeons, homing pigeons, racing pigeons. And it is just an amazing thing to do to actually have the opportunity to see eggs laid, babies being born, raise them, train them to fly. They're homing pigeons, so they always come back to where they were born. Anyway, I have a strong interest in birds, and I encourage everyone. I saw that Irene has a bird feeder outside her house. Recently, I've been reading some books about slow birding. And the idea behind slow birding is that you're not trying to just create a life list of birds and tick them off. But if you have a backyard, the idea is just to work with the birds that you see in your backyard. Maybe pick one and just watch its behavior for days and days and days and just learn about it, journal about it, maybe take pictures of it, maybe sketch it, maybe just start a sketch and just observe the bill, what shape the bill is, what the color of the bill is, but get to know a particular bird. Just pick one. Maybe it's a robin. Robins are great to look at and observe. I won't go into more details because maybe we'll have a whole program about mindful birding or slow birding. But the idea is to move away from the fast food culture and go to the slow bird culture. I have something that I wanted to read, and I don't know, hopefully I won't bore people. It'll only take a few minutes. But one of my earliest experiences with connecting with nature, when I was in high school, I was fortunate to read Henry David's Thoreau Walden. And it struck a chord, which has kept with me all my life, about just that kind of connection with nature. So I have a short reading. It might take 3 minutes. Hopefully it won't bore anyone, and hopefully it might inspire someone. So here we go. Henry David Thoreau wrote this 180 years ago. He built a cabin on Walden Pond and he lived in it for 2 years. And this was his writing was done at that time. So please bear with me and I hope you enjoy this. Here we go. But while we are confined to books, though most select and classic, and read only particular written languages, which are themselves but dialects and provincial, we are in danger of forgetting the language which all things and events speak without metaphor, which alone is copious and standard. Much is published, but little printed. The rays which stream through the shutter will no longer be remembered when the shutter is wholly removed. No method or discipline can supersede the necessity of being forever on the alert. What is a college course of history or philosophy or poetry, no matter how well selected, or the best society, or the most admirable routine of life, compared with the discipline of looking at what is to be seen? Will you be a reader, a student, merely, or a seer? Read your fate, see what is before you, and walk on into futurity. Now he's talking about his personal experience at the cabin. I did not read books for the first summer. I hoed beans. Nay, often I did better than this. There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work, whether of the head or hands. I love broad margins to my life. Sometimes in the summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in reverie amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in my west window, or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance. I realized what the Orientals meant by contemplation and forsaking of works. For most part, I minded not how the hours went. The day advanced as if to light some work of mine. It was morning, and lo, now it is evening, and nothing memorable is accomplished. Instead of singing like the birds, I silently smiled at my incessant good fortune. As the sparrows had its trill sitting on the hickory before my door, so had I my chuckle or suppressed warble, which he might hear out of my nest. If you've all at moments experienced a real moment of the present now and found yourself chuckle, you'll understand what Thoreau experienced here.
There's someone who would like to go next?
I could go.
Thanks, Sarah.
So I've been on the steering committee for a couple of years, but I'm kind of in a sabbatical for a couple months right now, just for health reasons. But the interesting thing is the health reasons have to do with all my efforts to tighten up our house. And those efforts backfired because we ended up with mold in our house, and I can't live there right now. And I'm really feeling well supported by a lot of people. It wouldn't be possible to deal with this by myself. And also I wanted to just follow up on what Dickie just said about slow birding. We have a slow birding situation in our front yard. We have an eagle's nest at Harvey's Lake, right across the street from us, and we've had to keep our cats in. So I think the songbird population may increase as a result of that. And we get to watch this nest. I mean, literally, we can see the nest without binoculars, but we can really watch what they're doing. And we're kind of expecting that there will be young eagles being hatched at some point. So that's been really an interesting turn of events, all of it. And I'm glad to be here celebrating Earth Day with you.
Will I go next, Irene?
Oh, terrific. Thanks, Gregory.
So I'm Greg, and I'm here in Oxford in England. So you've probably heard of Oxford. So I'm surrounded by a lot of people who think they know stuff, which is very interesting. And I've been on the steering committee. I think this is my third year now. And I tend to do the minutes of the meetings. And as of this year, I facilitate or host the steering committee meetings as well, which is always a joy. As you can see, I have a lovely team of people that I work with, so it's fantastic. I am, with regards to my involvement in environmental issues, I am involved in the Wildlife Trust movement in the UK, which is a federation of 46 different charities, of which I am a trustee of my local Wildlife Trust, which is one of the largest ones in the UK, and it covers three counties here in the southeast of England. And we have 85 nature reserves, which we are responsible for. We're involved in campaigning for better regulation and compliance as well within our communities, and driving our government to take more appropriate steps to support the recovery of wildlife in the UK. And we're very much keen on encouraging landscape scale recovery, which is really the only way we can go in the current climate, or the changing climate, perhaps I should say, given that where we have historically been protecting species in place, now the climate crisis is making wildlife populations move, and they need to be able to have corridors in which to move about the country. So we are involved in that process as well, and campaigning to deliver that, which is an uphill struggle, I can tell you. I'd also like to perhaps offer a short reading. I thought it might be appropriate to read from someone who I think is probably very familiar to most of you, Gary Snyder. We've already heard about Turtle Island from Deborah earlier, and this is from Turtle Island. It's actually Four Changes, which is included in Turtle Island. And I was struck, I'm not going to read it all, I'm just going to read a passage from it. But I was struck how accurately Gary had nailed our predicament over half a century ago. And it's just a shame our politicians are not so good at keeping up with all of this wonderful wisdom. So I'm going to be reading from the section on consumption. The condition. Everything that lives eats food and is food in turn. This complicated animal, man, rests on a vast and delicate pyramid of energy transformations. To grossly use more than you need to destroy is biologically unsound. Much of the production and consumption of modern societies is not necessary or conducive to spiritual and cultural growth, let alone survival, and is behind much greed and envy, age-old causes of social and international discord. Situation. Man's careless use of resources and his total dependence on certain substances such as fossil fuels are having harmful effects on all the other members of the life network. The complexity of modern technology renders whole populations vulnerable to the deadly consequences of the loss of any one key resource. Instead of independence, we have overdependence on life-giving substances such as water, which we squander. Many species of animals and birds have become extinct in the service of fashion fads or fertilizer or industrial oil. The soil is being used up. In fact, mankind has become a locust-like blight on the planet that will leave a bare cupboard for its own children. All the while, in a kind of addict's dream of affluence, comfort, external progress, using the great achievements of science to produce software and swill. Goal, balance, harmony, humility, growth, which is a mutual growth with redwood and quail, to be a member of the great community of living creatures. True affluence is not needing anything. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
I'm happy to
thank you.
Tell a story that many of you have already heard. But Greg, what you read just teared up a little bit here. Thank you all for being here. When I was very young, I lived in Louisiana, in the bayou. Not in the bayou itself, but in the landscape of the bayou. I lived in a dirt street that dead-ended into the bayou. It was called West Claude Street in Lake Charles, Louisiana. My father was a bomber pilot for the U.S. Air Force, so we moved every 2 or 3 years. But I had the good fortune to live in Lake Charles, Louisiana from age 4 to age 8. Remember that. Remember when you were 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8? Those are extraordinary years of curiosity and excitement, you know, the world, especially if you can be outside in a place, you know, that has live oaks and Spanish moss and a bayou. It was extraordinary environment for a tomboy, which I still am, even though I now wear earrings and lipstick. So I had all of my friends were boys in the neighborhood, very rural, tiny neighborhood. And of course, summer is very long in Louisiana. And we spent a lot of time outdoors. And I remember the smells, especially the smells. Everything was so rich and, you know, rotting, amazing smells. And right behind us, right behind our house, which we couldn't see it because the forest was thick. But I could smell the neighbors behind us had prize-winning roses, really prize-winning roses. You know, they entered them into contests, and extraordinary roses that, and that was a very rich smell. And they raised hogs, which was another extraordinarily rich odor. And right down at the end of our street, very short, you know, maybe it had six or seven houses on it, was the bayou. So, you know, it was the street just disappeared into the water, which was full of catfish and frogs and snakes and all kinds of wonderful critters. And my friends and I delighted in watching the tadpoles and in fact catching them in the spring when they were still just little, you know, that they look like, the only thing that comes to mind is sperm. You know, they're just like a little single quotation mark. And they were dark, they were blackish color and very tiny. I mean, less than half an inch. And we would monitor where the eggs, you could see the eggs on the top of the water, a gel-like mass of frog eggs. And we would watch them every day. We would check on them to see if tadpoles had hatched. And then we would scoop up, you know, a cupful of tadpoles and bring them home to a bucket and watch them. And I don't have any idea how we fed them, but I know we did, because we would watch them as they sprouted their little back legs. So then they were this little, you know, smooth little shapes with a tail and two back legs. And now I wonder if I'm telling you the truth. Did the back legs or the front legs come first? It might have been the front legs. I think it was. But still, they're less than a half an inch long. And then the back legs came, and eventually the tail disappears. And I have no idea what the time, how long that took. But we all would, you know, we would report every day to each other on our own little tadpoles and how they were doing. And we'd all look at each other's tadpoles. And then eventually when the tail disappeared and they had four legs, we would have to take them back into the bayou, and, you know, they would grow into larger frogs. We took very good care of them. But watching that transformation from a tadpole to a minute frog was, it was one of the most exciting things that I did in my life at that age. And then one year, my father, the colonel, neglected to bring the kiddie pool, you know, the big plastic pool that was in the backyard. He neglected to empty it and put it away for the winter, like there's winter in Louisiana. Now that I live in Nova Scotia, I recognize there's no winter in Louisiana. But so in the spring, I discovered, and I apologize to my friends who've already heard this story, I discovered that there were frog eggs in my pool. And it was, you know, probably 5 feet in diameter, maybe. There were a million frog eggs in my pool. My own frog eggs, right there in my backyard. And I watched them hatch into tadpoles. I had a million tadpoles in my yard. It was miraculous. And of course, all my friends were very jealous of me. And I watched them turn into tiny frogs over weeks. It seemed like weeks. It seemed like forever for them to become these minuscule frogs. And then my father, one day I came home from school, so I must have been 6 or 7 at that time. And my father had emptied the pool, and all the tiny frogs were on the lawn. Well, they can't survive on the lawn. You know, the birds were eating them. They were far away from the water. It was one of the most devastating experiences I had as a child, that my million little tiny frogs were drying up in the yard. And I'm still working on forgiving my father for that particular act. But I tell you this because it sealed my relationship with the more than human world. Thank goodness. And thank you for listening.
Thank you, Deborah. I had never heard that story, so it was new to me. Thank you.
Deborah, thank you so much. I share that memory. We used to take the tadpoles from the irrigation ditches at the little farms trap in the neighborhood part of Los Angeles when I was young. And I remember watching them with such fascination. Thank you so much for that memory.
And Deborah, you're not the only one, as well as Paula, because I would take the eggs from a pond with some algae and seaweed and put it in a fish tank in my room and watch them turn into frogs. And then I have to move the frogs out because frogs weren't allowed in our house at the time.
And I too have a tadpole story. I grew up in California, where there are the celebrated bullfrogs of Calaveras County. And if you can imagine your tadpole on steroids, these things are like 3 inches long. The tadpole, the polliwog, is 3 inches long. And these bullfrogs, they're like woofers, but like these really deep croaks, right? And so that was almost like you're mentioning, an annual pilgrimage to the bullfrog pond. Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. Paula?
I just discovered this at the last moment, so obviously I'm not part of the committee or hadn't planned anything, but something that has been in a couple of things, something that's been an ongoing conversation between my son and I over the years. He's something of a philosophy student. He's done some writing, but one of the converse things that is really an important sort of endeavor for him is the examination of the fact we as a human species, think and conceive of ourselves as being this sort of epitome of evolution. And so his sort of has this drive to sort of bring an awareness of the fact that human beings are not ontologically in any way superior or profoundly different. And more the proof of sort of learning, I mean, the compassion and friendship and family among, you know, a herd of elephants or, you know, various animal species are now, as we're becoming, many of us sort of suspected and is now being proven more and more, even among the plant life, there's this extraordinary intelligence in different forms, perhaps even awarenesses. And for Kim, the importance of this for us as human beings is that that awareness can be brought as an understood, lived knowledge of how we relate, that it would almost by definition profoundly change the attitude of human being, of the human species. Our sort of one great power is we have this ability to manipulate and destroy and play with things. And I think for me, that's a basis of sort of all of the various endeavors that we all have. Personally, I live in a somewhat isolated situation. I sort of profoundly miss having connection to nature. I live in a rather isolated, not particularly pleasant neighborhood of Los Angeles at the moment. But as some of you, Dickie will know somewhat, though what I did when he knew me was somewhat prescribed. I'm a painter. And for many years did not work or paint. And as when I came back to it, discovered that and I've done, someone described my, one of my teachers some years, a few years ago when I was at Evergreen State College, described my work as biomorphic. And very often it isn't something intentional. It's merely a responsive thing. But in doing figurative work, found that what I was doing came out of some awareness or connection to the fact that, and this gets into something where I find really difficult defining it, is as beings in a human body, most of us don't experience that actual sensation of being in a body. And much of my work is sort of evolved in provoking some awareness of that sensation. And the more that sensation becomes sort of known, something we're aware of, the more we become aware of that we're not the same as or at one with so much as a profoundly connected piece of the rest of manifest phenomena. And my paintings and my work at the moment is sort of what I do, is very much involved in, by putting on paper or on canvas or in ceramic form, some reference to or of that sensation in myself, of my, the sensation of my in communication and that I might provoke in others a moment of connection that would help open that little moment. So I'm sorry, I'm rambling a bit. I hope any of that made sense. Thank you.
Thanks, Paula. Richard John just wrote about Robin Wall Kimmerer's work, and I was about to sort of share this book as well. I'm currently reading Gathering Moss by her, and the intelligence and the wisdom that we can learn from the plants is completely true. And she happens to be an unbelievable author. Just her sentences are just gorgeous. So highly recommend reading Sweetgrass or any of this, or going to hear her speak. I wanted to briefly say the history of Touching the Earth Collective began in 2018. And then prior to that, when the Sakyong had asked us to write a letter to the responding to the letter of the Morning Sun about what we were going to, what we could do for the world, I had written that I wanted to help protect the earth, that was what I was going to put my focus on, and then became a fellow in the Green Faith organization. And that was in 2011. I did their fellowship program, and it's an interfaith environmental organization. And I loved it so much that I stayed with them and helped them with other retreats and other fellowships, and then was asked to sit on the board. And then currently I'm the vice chair of the board of directors of Green Faith. So that's another place where I put my energies. And then following that, I felt like I'm not following that sort of a continuation of that work. So I felt like I wanted to bring it back home and started the Touching the Earth Collective with four other people, and it quickly grew to the collective it is today. And just wanted to say that a group of us right now are reading or working on the Act of Hope program class that Joanna Macy has set up online. And the first part of her spiral is gratitude. And I want to reemphasize my profound gratitude to the other people in the steering committee over the years, and then currently. This is an extraordinary experience to work with others in such a playful and serious way. And I thank you so much to Deborah, Gregory, Sarah, and Dickie for being on this journey, to steering this sailing ship together. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And we also have David Takahashi, who is an adjunct, lone wolf, fabulous eco-dharma doula. And before I pass the baton to David, I wanted to share a book that came in the mail yesterday. I read Janet Malcolm's Still Photos. It's a really beautiful, she's a wonderful author and writes essays. And then at a certain point, she made the decision to take some photographs of burdock leaves. And it's not nature at its, like, I don't want to say most beautiful, because these are so beautiful, but not at where what traditionally people think of. It's sort of it's the climax of a just opening one. Just for instance, this is one of her photos, and it's just wonderful. And Michael Pollan wrote, "Seldom has an American artist in any genre offered such clear images of the natural world, skirting all the usual landscape of convention, sublime, sentimental. Janet Malcolm has turned her wintry gaze on these most ordinary leaves, and the result is wondrous to behold. Here is the heartbreaking peculiarity of nature and the ravages of time made flesh. At once clinical and poignant, these photographs change the way I look at the green world around me." Thank you.
I would like to also mention that our Jim Wagner is here, without whom we would not have the beautiful website we have. So thank you, Jim.
Thank you for inviting me to do whatever I can do and supporting me so that I can help you.
Hooray, Jim. And a backward glance and thank you to Sophie Leger, who was the original person who said, "You need a website, I'll do it for you." She did it. So.
Thank you. Shall we invite Mr. Takahashi to share?
Yes.
I would like to ask if anybody else would care to step up on the soapbox. So, yes, it has been one of my life pleasures to be a part of the Touching the Earth Collective from day zero and to enjoy its unfolding and evolution over these years. I am going to share, well, the first thing I'd like is when things get quiet enough, I begin to hear a sound not unlike a bullfrog, very deep, rumbly sound, and sometimes I think it's my mind working, but I am coming to realize that it is the sound of a sea, S-E-A, a sea of uncertainty that we find ourselves in the deep end of. We are in the deep end of a sea of uncertainty, and when things quiet down, you can hear it. And I encourage you to get that quiet so you can hear the sea of uncertainty. What I'm going to share with you is a piece from one of my mentors, Meg Wheatley. She wrote a book called Song Line. And this is a chapter in Song Line titled Islands of Sanity. Islands of Sanity in a Sea of Uncertainty. So here we go. Islands of Sanity are healthy human communities led by sane leaders. They consciously create themselves as islands, removing themselves from the insanity that is destroying community. The insanity of leaders using fear to escalate separation and conflict. These islands resist the forces of separation and stay together to solve their own problems. They can't solve the global issues, but they do create strong, harmonious communities. Following Teddy Roosevelt's dictum to do what you can, where you are, with what you have. Do what you can, where you are, with what you have. They stopped looking elsewhere for help. They turn to one another and discover the deep well of creativity and caring in every human that comes rushing to the surface when people are offered a chance to contribute. As community, These islands have learned to work together for what they most care about. They collaborate, they converse, they celebrate, they continue. Once they've solved a problem, small or large, they are eager to take on the next challenge with each solution. Their relationships strengthen because they've worked well together. They learn how to think well together, welcoming diversity in all its forms. They know that with diverse perspectives, they can solve complex problems. Implementation becomes straightforward when everyone has contributed to the solution. It is important that we are here to witness them and to take heart from their successes, but don't misinterpret. These communities are not signs of hope. They could have been, and years ago, many people worked hard to create them as beacons of hope. They believed, as I did, that if they grew in number, leaders would learn from them and the world would change. They presented real solutions, alternatives to the life-destroying dynamics and beliefs that rule this time. There was great hope that these proven examples would become our global future, a world of sustainable, harmonious, wise human societies. But this failed. The forces of greed and power, the destruction of people and planet, the flood could not be stopped. As this became evident, heartbroken and powerless, we asked what was still possible. Our response is to create islands of sanity in the midst of this destructive sea. We work to build islands strong enough to withstand the tidal waves of destruction we know are coming. People who create islands of sanity are warriors. They understand where our society is the pattern of collapse. They distinguish between what's possible and what's not. They refuse to feel powerless. They refuse to be consumed by grief and anger. They do not become cynical. They find places where good human communities are still possible. The last paragraph. An island of sanity may be a physical community, a congregation, a school, a work team, or something within a larger organization. It has a clear boundary that protects it from the destructive dynamics swirling all around. This boundary isn't rigid, it's semi-permeable. People stay aware of what's going on, information and people pass through it, but it is a definite boundary, a filter, and a protection. Inside this protected space, leaders can create the conditions for people to be creative, generous, and kind. They use practices of collaboration, engagement, and good thinking. They create a space of possibility, encouragement, and power for everyone there, and they take great care to defend this precious jewel of what is possible. Doesn't that sound like the Shambhala Touching the Earth Collective?
Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, David. I have to admit that it also sounds like the amazing group of people at the Halifax Shambhala Center that I've been working with for 2 years, the Advisory Council.
So we're an archipelago.
These things are, you know, these kinds of initiatives are arising all over the place. We're all part of them. Thank goodness.
Islands of sanity connected like the beads on a mala.
Aren't we lucky?
Did we hear from Munich, by the way? Mm-mm. Guten Tag.
Yes, it's quite late in Germany. It's 10 o'clock, and I'm tired. Yes, it's my first time that I take part in the in your group. Women of our Shambhala Munich is active in the group. I think she's Karin. Perhaps somebody knows her, and she will visit the program in the Chinchilling in summer. Yeah, so I will be informed. I couldn't be there, but I will be there before. But she will attend the meeting, and she will inform us in Munich. So I'm just by incident, because I'm interested, especially in the day tomorrow. Unfortunately, it was a little bit too late for us to organize something, but I'm on a retreat tomorrow, but I will do a small lasan on my own. We are a very small group, so for me, I thought, yes, just to get a little bit of impetus from this meeting for tomorrow and perhaps for the future. So I will stay in contact with the group via Karin, who will attend the meeting. Yeah, that's all from my side. I haven't prepared anything. So, but I was very interested about the remarks Richard Swerbeck was making, because I am part of a group in Munich who try to protect the birds. And I'm also interested, not a real bird watcher, but I'm interested in birds, and I'm also watching them in our garden. And we work in our group, local group, on protecting birds, but also the environment in our local area. It's called, the organization is called LBV, which means Landesbund für Vogelschutz. It's German. So that's just a little bit there to get an idea who I am. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. We've done a lot of reading today. I just wanted to read one final short paragraph from The Comfort of Crows. A Backyard Year by Margaret Rankle. This world is burning, and there's no time to put down the water buckets. For just an hour, put down the water buckets anyway. Take your cue from the bluebirds, who have no faith in the future, but who build the future nevertheless, leaf by leaf, straw by straw, shaping them into the roundness of the world. Turn your face up to the sky. Listen. The world is trembling into possibility. The world is reminding us that this is what the world does best. New life, rebirth, the greenness that rises out of ashes. And we could also read it as the greenness that rises out of Ashe.
Ooh.
Same spelling.
Thank you. Thank you, Irene. Wow. Well, thank you all for being here today. And I want to thank Shambhala Online for allowing us to do this Sunday gathering here, and also, which does cost them some money, so we'll share the donation link in the chat in case any of you are inspired to make a donation to Shambhala Online. I want to thank the steering committee of Touching the Earth Collective and everyone else who's involved with Touching the Earth Collective. Please continue to celebrate this earth in whatever way inspires you. And take care of yourself and each other. Shall we bow again?
Thanks, Deborah. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, please like and subscribe to the podcast. We hope you can join us again soon. You can find out more about upcoming live Shambhala Sunday gatherings and our podcast at shambhalaonline.org/Sunday-gatherings/.